The prophet Isaiah saw and heard the seraphim crying out, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. The whole earth is filled with His glory." As Christians and stewards of creation, are we ready to give a defense of God's glory? This is Apologetics Profile, a podcast ministry of Watchman Fellowship Incorporated, Arlington, Texas, helping and equipping you to better understand the world of non-Christian ideas and religions, one conversation at a time.
In 1887, Charles Darwin expressed his own concerns about natural selection being adequate to explain the development and trustworthiness of the human mind. Quote, "With me, the horrid doubt always arises whether the convictions of man's mind, which has been developed from the mind of the lower animals, are of any value or at all trustworthy. Would anyone trust the convictions of a monkey's mind, if there are any convictions in such a mind?" End quote. Christian philosopher Alvin Plantinga believes Darwin to be correct. Quote, "Naturalistic evolution gives one a reason to doubt that human cognitive faculties produce, for the most part, true beliefs," end quote. Plantinga calls this Darwin's doubt. Modern science, however, has virtually buried Darwin's doubt. Not because they have solved the problem of human thought, language, and consciousness, but because science, by and large, no longer thinks of man as created, but rather as a composite of disparate physical systems. Modern science takes human thought for granted, but can't finally explain it. As cosmologist and theologian David Alcade suggests, quote, "Modern science has reduced the understanding of being from actuality to facticity," end quote. In short, there are facts about the physical world and nothing else. Our actuality, being divine image bearers created by God for His glory, has been, it appears, expunged by the methods and tools of fact-finding scientific specialists. Alcade notes that such a development in the sciences has given us a, quote, "new functionalist notion of truth. Truth is equated with usefulness and verified by results. As a result, modern science is incapable of being integrated into a more comprehensive order of knowledge or recognizing any access to truth other than via the scientific method," end quote. Alcade goes on to observe that certain scientists, quote, "consider science, especially physics, as the first philosophy, and claim that science should expand itself in order to conquer every possible era of human knowledge, dismissing everything that cannot be subject to the self-imposed rigor of the scientific method," end quote. In short, only that which is useful to science, and only that which can be discovered or achieved through the scientific method, only those facts about the physical world that can be empirically demonstrated, are considered to be true. This particular philosophy is known as scientism, and you can hear our two-part episode on scientism we did with cosmologist Dr. Luke Barnes. Links can be found in the notes below. The idea that only what is practical is true is a theory of truth called pragmatism, a school of philosophy that included such pioneering thinkers as William James and educational theorist and philosopher John Dewey. But as a theory of truth, it fails, for practicality will vary from person to person and group to group. What is practical for me may not be practical for you. What then is the proper philosophy of truth? As Pontius Pilate asks Jesus, what is truth? There is no recorded response from Jesus to Pilate's question. And later, when Pilate asks Jesus, where are you from? John writes that, quote, Jesus gave him no answer, end quote. Pilate became somewhat indignant, quote, you do not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you and I have authority to crucify you, end quote. Jesus answered, quote, you would have no authority over me unless it had been given to you from above, end quote. Pilate was unaware he was conversing with the God of the universe, unaware that his earthly authority had been given to him from above, unaware of who Jesus was or where he came from, unaware of the truth. Though the Bible is silent about what happened to Pilate after Jesus' resurrection, some historical sources suggest Pilate died by execution or suicide in 39 AD. Analogously, there are a few parallels between Pilate and secular science. On the one hand, science is examining the very handiwork of God, the heavens and the earth, which are incessantly declaring the glory of God. But the scientists do not see it, or worse, they attempt to suppress it. There is, in the study of the heavens, a kind of reverence, excitement, even a little fear and awe. But there persists a failure to recognize God's workmanship. Instead of the heavens, it is merely chaotic, empty space. And the consequences for such a worldview are not finally just a matter of taste. In our last episode, I mentioned a book I was reading by a secular cosmologist. Consider some of the words used to describe the universe. These all appear together in just three paragraphs. Quote, space, hurtling, collide, flung chaotically, suddenly smashing together, explosion, ignite, chaotic tangle, irradiated, doomed, falling, galactic train wreck, head-on stellar impacts, boil, old, dying, cataclysmic, cannibalized, consumed, interstellar car crash, and collisions, end quote. In just three paragraphs, suddenly I'm wondering why a book about the universe is giving me thoughts of despair. I've run across these same kinds of chaotic descriptions about the cosmos in other popular works by Dr. Carl Sagan and Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. In short, the language we use to describe the cosmos and ourselves is of the utmost importance. Is the cosmos an ordered system lovingly and carefully arranged by God for His glory? Or is it just an amalgam of chaos, death, and destruction, among which we are the unintended byproducts of cosmic thermonuclear detritus? Whether it is science, a philosophy of truth, or a description about the universe, the words we use should be in accordance with the actuality of the universe and our very being, with what it all is intended to mean. The tongue, though it be small, can kindle quite a fire. We must speak with wisdom. The universe and our very lives are, in fact, the creation and handiwork of God, done through and for His Son, the Lord Jesus Christ, for His glory. He brought order where there was no order, but the world which is opposed to Him seeks to undo and denigrate that order. Anything which stands in opposition to God is finally empty Antichrist philosophy, a stronghold that must be torn down and demolished. But it is only through the treasures of wisdom and knowledge in Christ that we are able to overcome the world and its opposition to the message of the cross. Without God, however, Darwin's doubt, as we heard in the opening of the broadcast, remains a significant and tragic problem. As we begin part two of our conversation about good philosophy, Dr. Paul Gould outlines a correspondence theory of truth and how we can know and test truth claims. We also talk about David Hume's objections a bit and conclude with some philosophical and practical counsel on the problem of evil. Dr. Paul Gould.
I mean, I think that it is true that the correspondence theory of truth is the best way to understand the nature of what truth is, right? So truth obtains when our thought or our belief or a statement that we make corresponds to the way the world actually is, right? If I say the moon is made of green cheese, well, I've uttered a sentence, that doesn't correspond to the way the world is. So that proposition, that sentence is false, right? But if I say the Eiffel Tower is in Paris, well, I've uttered something that matches, right, with reality. So it's a true statement. And so I think not only is it the common sense pre-philosophical view of what truth is, I think it's the only defensible view of the nature of truth. So truth is that which corresponds to reality. I think that that's right. And then I think when we ask a separate question, you know, how do we test worldviews? I tend to use the language of story lately, you know, which story is alive and understands you. In other words, we all long for a story that's both true to the way the world is and true to the way the world ought to be, right? So there's the truth and the satisfaction. We want both. We want a story that corresponds to the way the world is, that's reasonable. And we want a story that actually satisfies the deep longings of the heart. And that's where you get to those other two views, right? We want it. So I think coherence and pragmatism, while they don't accurately describe the nature of truth, because we've already said truth is that which corresponds to the way the world is, I do think they're helpful tests for truth when we consider worldviews, you know, or stories, maximal stories about how things could go. We want a story that coheres, right? If there's logical contradictions, if it doesn't hang together in the right way, well, that's a reason to suspect, you know, the story or the worldview. And then, of course, the pragmatic test is not a good explanation for what truth is, but it's a great test of worldviews, right? Because we want, like I said, a story that satisfies, that pragmatically answers the deep existential questions. And I think on this, Christianity, you know, wins hands down, right? It corresponds to the way the world is. It's reasonable. That's the reasonable part. But it corresponds to the way the world ought to be, that it satisfies. That's this desirable part. So that's why I love, like, C.S. Lewis. You know, he said that in Christianity, you have this perfect blend of reason and romance, you know, head and heart. And that's the beauty of Christianity. It doesn't veer off into this sort of austere high rationalism, but it doesn't veer off into this sort of swampy sentimentalism, but rather it respects both. And so when Lewis discovered Christianity, he called it, as you know, Dan, true myth, right? It satisfied the intellectual longing to correspond to the way the world is with their beliefs. But it's satisfied the deep longings of the heart for a story that understands me, right? And that's alive and that can actually deliver us genuine satisfaction. So that's the beauty of the Christian story. And that's how I connect, you know, the nature of truth and then those other concepts that are out there. And so I would just say, here's some tests that we can use to test different worldviews. And the most important one being correspondence. But here's two other tests. Does it satisfy the pragmatic test? And then does it satisfy the coherence test? So I'd kind of run it that way, because coherentism is a theory about the nature of truth, and that's false. And pragmatism is a theory about the nature of truth, and that's false.
Got it.
But there's something that we can take out of that, and that's how I would do it.
Excellent. All right. Well, that's very helpful, because I love philosophy, and I share your passion for it, but I'm certainly not as knowledgeable in the field as you are. But having delved into this world of epistemology the last month or two, I've seen so much more of the importance of applying good philosophy and seeing how it is applicable to Christian theology. A lot of Christian apologetics, as you know, offers philosophical arguments for the existence of God, which you and Jamie have in your book. You talk about the classic philosophical arguments for God's existence and how they are not just something we made up yesterday, but these are centuries old, and they've been around forever, and they've addressed the skeptical questions from centuries ago. But it's interesting, Paul, because you see this younger generation of people, I would include myself in this, that were raised on this idea of being ignorant of the past. And so when you have something like a Dawkins book come out, it seems new and invigorating, and, you know, the new atheism and the general quick success of the whole new atheist movement with publications and whatnot. It seems novel, it seems new, because people are unfamiliar with the historical narrative of the Christian faith. And you have mentioned many times now this idea of story. And of course, there is a story about the past, about how these ideas have interacted with one another. You and Jamie deal with a David Hume, who a lot of skeptics are still, quote, in dialogue with, historically speaking, whenever you talk about miracles or the rationality, the rationality of the resurrection of Jesus, David Hume inevitably comes up. And it seems like a lot of us are bereft of the philosophical tools to address the Humean kind of skepticism that sort of was put to bed centuries ago by many philosophers. Do you find that Hume still dominates the conversation for, you know, unbelieving students and people that are skeptical or atheist philosophers? Why is he still relevant today, and why are people still talking about him? Does he have a cogent argument, or is there some good philosophy that can untangle his shoelace, so to say?
Well, interestingly, so right now, you know, my main area in philosophy is one of the sub-disciplines called metaphysics. Metaphysics is, just to give a brief definition, it would be the philosophical study of the nature and structure of reality. And so I'm really interested in that question. And interestingly, it's so interesting that you brought up Hume. The two, I think, dominant views of the way the world is, metaphysically speaking, as it turns out, Dan, one of them is called the Neo-Humean view, and the other one is called the Neo-Aristotelian view. And I'm decidedly on the Neo-Aristotelian side myself. But the Neo-Humean view, it's even named after Hume because he basically, I think as we went through the Enlightenment, which is, you know, a period of time that took place 300-400 years ago, where a bunch of thinkers were beginning to sort of shed the religious impulse that, you know, dominated the first 1500 years of the church in the West. And you know, kind of, this is when we're embracing reason, we're told. And Hume was kind of at the tail end of that. And he articulated in some pretty common sense ways, some views about knowledge and about the world that were coupled, I think, maybe erroneously with the rise of modern science that was taking place with Locke specifically. Newton and Locke. And so basically empiricism wins the day and naturalism wins the day by the time Hume comes around. And that's kind of the rest of the story is now we're told in a Neo-Humean world. And what that means briefly, because this is gifted to us from Hume, is that there's no dependency relations in the world. There's just little bits of atoms called corpuscles flying around in the void, you know, and the Neo-Aristotelian view would be the opposite. It would say things like, no, there's all these dependency relations in the world where there's, you know, a scale of being and there's creatures on all up and down the scale of being that have various powers and potentialities and essences and natures that are four different things like you mentioned earlier. And that's the more ancient view. And I think it's actually the right view, but Hume is still haunting us there in metaphysics. When it comes to philosophy of religion, which you mentioned and is, you know, famous chapter 10 in his book on the inquiry concerning human understanding. Chapter 10 was on miracles, and his things that he said there are still haunting us. And even if in the academic world they've been put to bed, I think sort of popularly speaking, this Humean idea that, miracles can't happen is very much part of the zeitgeist of our age. And so, yeah, he's still with us. Probably not so much in the academy, although he is there too, because I just told you one area where he is. But I think in the popular mindset, his arguments are things that we do need to deal with. And it's not like we haven't dealt with them, but in every generation, like you said, given the ahistorical nature, and increasingly ahistorical nature, given the digital age, we've got to continue to address the arguments in new and fresh ways when they come up.
And it strikes at the very core, Paul, of I know Hume's objection and focuses on the resurrection. The gentleman who started the street epistemology movement in 2012, Peter Boghossian, has a lecture called Jesus and the Easter Bunny and Other Bizarre Things. And so Hume is just saying this is bizarre. It's strange, it's unusual, it's unaccounted for. No rational person would believe it. And it seems to me that the force of Enlightenment rationality, the science, the natural sciences, whatever then you have Darwin coming along. That this idea of logic and reason and rationality, one of the chief tactics I see in the skeptical counter-apologetic is this overarching fear that you don't want to be perceived as irrational or illogical. And then something like the resurrection is entirely irrational. Talking donkeys, I mean, you go down the list, you've heard it all the counter-apologetic arguments that suggest this is irrational, this is irrational, this is irrational, this is irrational. And what never really happens in any of those arguments is the skeptic or even Hume or any of the Enlightenment thinkers, the French philosophes going all the way back to Denis Diderot and that whole movement. What is the ground for, in your understanding, professionally speaking, when you're dealing with the top skeptic philosophers, what is the ground for logic and reason? There only seems to be a few options available to you if you deny God's existence. You only have a couple of things. I think it was Thomas Nagel in his 2012 Mind and Cosmos. He's like, there's no way you can atomize that our brains, the corpuscles that you mentioned earlier, perhaps in a physics term today, there's no way that we can have a bunch of little subatomic rational particles that comprise our contingent rationality that we are ontologically as human beings. What is the final ground for rationality, logic, and reason for skeptic philosophers today? How do you see that dialogue?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think you basically have two options. If you remove God from the picture, and these are the two options that people will say one or the other of. One is that there is no explanation, that laws of logic and rationality are just necessary truths, and necessary truths just exist for no reason. Now, notice, though, if we go that route, we've already kind of adopted a kind of spooky world, right? Because the Neo-Humean, this is the other option, the Neo-Humean tells us there are no necessary connections, remember? So there can't be these spooky necessary laws of logic that constrain how we ought to think. There are no oughts in this world. So that's already a kind of Platonic atheism that at least is pushing, you know, in the direction of theism. And we can talk about some other problems with that. But that's one option, is just say it's a brute fact, that there's these necessary truths, and that's how you ground logic and therefore rationality. The other way, which is more consistent with the Humean way of thinking, and remember, on the Neo-Humean picture, there's no dependencies. And so what the laws of logic and rationality become then are just human convention. And so they're relative. They're relative to a conceptual scheme or to a culture, to a certain convention. But then, if that's all logic is, well, then why should I subscribe to your logic? You know, and why should I, be beholden by the imperialism of Western laws of non-contradiction, you know, or something like that? And so those are the two options, really. Now, on theism, you know, you have, so on my view, I think that the laws of logic are grounded in a perfectly rational God. And in fact, the laws of logic, which are just rules about how propositions ought to go together, I actually identify them with God's thoughts about how thinking ought to go. So for me, propositions are divine thoughts. And since laws of logic are thoughts about how thoughts should go together, I'm sorry, rules about how propositions should go together, well, that means that the laws of logic are God's thoughts about how thoughts should be put together. And they're, of course, all grounded in a perfectly rational God. So there, on the theistic story, you don't have these sort of brute, spooky givens existing out in some Platonic heaven. No, you've grounded these necessary truths in the right place, in a necessary, personal being that's, you know, perfectly rational. Mm. So that's my quick thoughts.
Well, it seems to me, as you've suggested this, it's very easy to connect these dots, to say that, as you said at the beginning of our talk, the grain of reality, the reality is uttered in a certain specific way. Wisdom is part of the warp and woof of the fabric of the cosmos and of our ontology, and embedded in the very creation are phraseologies of sentences, if you will, of divine speech. And that's what, you know, you and I just did that book, The Story of the Cosmos, and that the heavens are declaring the glory of God. Day to day pours forth speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. And so there is divine wisdom pouring out of the heavens, pouring out of every aspect of creation. And logic and reason seem to be sort of the highway, the metaphysical highway, the grain of reality. It's like getting on a highway and going in the right direction. It's going to be very difficult if you get on the highway and go the other direction. You might eventually get to your spot, but not before you're arrested or have an accident. But logic seems to be the the way, if you will. I mean, the Greek for road or way, this is what Jesus says of himself in John, right? I am the way, I'm the grain, I'm the truth, I'm the life. And to me, I mean, this is just a simpleton's perspective, but look at the brilliance of John using the Greek word logos, which philosophically predated John using it in the prologue. But logos, Jesus is the logos. And there are so many disciplines within the science, Paul, as you know, that end with L-O-G-Y, you know, the study of biologos, the study of life, right? Or psychology, the study of the mind. And so I see the world is, as you've said in your books, the world is God-bathed. You know, we are swimming in his language, and logic and reason seem to be the way in which we are word-centered beings. Our ontology is verbal and communicative and story-oriented. And so it seems to go against the grain of logic. A friend and I were talking about this recently. You look at even sort of the language of DNA in the sciences today, where DNA is like a code, right? But what do we think of when we think of a code? We think of a disinterested computer programmer who just punches in some bytes, and then the thing comes into being, and then we play with it. And the computer engineer we never meet and we never talk to, it's just an impersonal code that was ordering things around. But if you look at the language of the Psalms, Psalm 19, how does Psalm 139 say that we are put together? We are knit together. In our mother's womb, that whole passage is one of love and of care. Think of knitting versus computer code. When you think of knitting, you think of the care of someone knitting something for you, the love, the care, the detail that goes into knitting versus computer code. I'm not saying computer code, you know, it's wrong to do computer code. But think of the nature of the personal versus the impersonal. If you go back to Newtonian physics and then the Enlightenment, you think of how impersonal the stories that we start telling ourselves become. Very mechanistic, deistic, impersonal, distant, cold, aloof. We have a whole chapter in Cosmos about space. You know, is that the right word for the cosmos? But I think, speak a little bit, if you would, to the necessity of finding the right kind of language to express our thoughts and our relationship to God and the world. Do you think that's incredibly important? Metaphors matter?
You know, it's interesting. Another gift from Hume is, you know, this picture of the world that he bequeathed to us. You mentioned that the world is today viewed as in mechanistic terms. You know, today the dominant metaphor to understand the world is that of a clock. But that wasn't how the world was conceived before Hume, right? The world was perceived in a more personal terms, that God was active in the lives of humans and in human history. And so I think metaphors are super important, actually, and our language, like you say, is super important to help us understand. I mean, it's so interesting just to think about one of the most important doctrines of the Christian faith, which is this doctrine of union with God or union with Christ. You know, I think as Christians, we're really good at saying what we're saved from. You know, we're saved from sin, but we're really bad at remembering what we're saved for. You know, that we're created for communion with God through union with God, with Christ. And it's interesting, every time in Scripture you have someone try to explain to us what the doctrine of union with Christ looks like, every single time they use a metaphor for us to understand it. So for Jesus, you know, John 15, it's the, you know, relationship with me is like the vine and the branches. Or, you know, Paul in Ephesians 5, the relationship that, you know, the most intimate relationship between a man and a woman is the metaphor to explain what it's like for Christ and his bride, the church. Or Peter, you know, the living stone and the stones of the temple, you know, is a way to understand this union, this doctrine of union with Christ. And so I think our words matter and the metaphors matter because they help us to understand, I think, at a deeper level, maybe even at the level of the imagination, which is, as C.S. Lewis would put it, the organ of meaning, you know, what our lives are all about. And so yes, we have to pay attention to our language. We have to pay attention to the imaginative stories that we inhabit and that how we conceive our life. And really, and this goes back to philosophy and this point about Hume, even the way that we conceive the world. Last thing I'll say, I love, you know, Calvin in the Institutes, he described the heavens and the earth as a dazzling theater of God's glory. And so I think that's a better metaphor for us to understand. I was just reading, teaching on this question, why did God create, you know, in my class, philosophy class yesterday. And we were looking at Calvin actually. And he says, he was explaining, you know, the spiritual lessons of creation. And he says, you know, imagine creation like a beautiful house, you know, with a chandelier and with, you know, with furnishings that are rich and full of diversity and beauty and order. And so, you know, even Calvin in the Institutes, imagine, you know, the universe like this beautiful house, or that the heavens are a dazzling theater of God's glory. I think that that's a better image or metaphor from which we can understand the divine drama and our place in it than, you know, the clockwork, impersonal order that we're told, you know, from Hume that we inhabit. So yeah, these kinds of things are super important. And this is why in my book, not the book that we're talking about here, but the other, another book I worked on called Cultural Apologetics, I talk about how that we need to, as Christians, rebaptize our imaginations, that we need to begin to see the world the way that Jesus does, and then to delight in the world the way Jesus does. And how does he see it? As you mentioned, as a God-bathed and a God-permeated world. And when we do that, we begin to, I think, you know, see Jesus correctly and then delight in the world and in Christ the way that we ought.
That's fantastic, Paul. I mean, it is incredible when, you know, it's overwhelming actually sometimes when I stop and ponder nature, and not just for the sake of pondering nature, but recognizing God's divine handiwork in every leaf or rainbow in the cloud or tint of blue sky, or even in difficulties, even in what we might call the silence or the hiddenness of God, contemplating the whole of creation as the grand ballroom. I mean, you think about, you know, the Globe Theater was where Shakespeare's plays were performed. And you think about the universe as the stage into which God enters and comes down into our human drama. You know, the greatest story ever told, goes up on the mountain to Calvary and then, you know, does what he does for us on the cross. The whole of the theater is arranged to point to that event and to the resurrection, the incarnation of the Son of God coming down in a body, being a man of sorrows. And so, you know, we've been talking about beauty and truth in Christ and wisdom and knowledge and the love of philosophy and a husband and wife relationship. Paul, as we wrap up here, I know this is a heady topic that could take hours and hours to unpack, but I'm sure some of our listeners at this time are going, okay, sounds all great, I'm on board with you, but, you know, my friend Bob at work, he's not a Christian because of the problem of evil. Philosophically, Paul, theologically, how would you help Bob? What can we say?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, the problem of evil, as you know, Dan, is one of the main, I mean, I think it's probably the strongest argument against God's existence is, you know, how could there be a holy, good, all-powerful God if yet there is evil, as Hume put it so aptly. Yeah, I mean, I think, again, it's helpful to make distinctions here. And what I would want to say is that, you know, it's true, evil and suffering and pain are in themselves bad things, right? They're horrific things. But the question, though, is, does God have a morally justified reason for allowing it? You know, I think most people, most philosophers, again, you're right, this would take a long time to explain. There used to be a day when atheists would say that it's a logical contradiction. You know, if God exists, if evil exists, it's a contradiction to say that God exists. And what I just said isn't explicitly a contradictory claim. And so you'd have to pull out a few premises, but there used to be a day when they thought that the existence of evil was actually entailed that God couldn't exist logically. Today, most people, most atheists, theists all agree that there's no logical contradiction, largely because Alvin Plantinga was said to have solved the logical problem by offering what he calls the free will defense. So now most of the action is in this, what's called the evidential problem for evil. And that's really the question, okay, God, if you exist, why would you allow these bad things to take place? And I guess the argument, just to formalize it, would go something like this. If God exists, there's no pointless evil, premise one. Premise two, there is pointless evil, conclusion, therefore probably God doesn't exist. So that's an evidential or probabilistic argument. Now, the key premise, though, that the theist would want to push back in is that second premise as I articulated it, is the idea that there's pointless evil. On the Christian story, there is no pointless evil, right? And so what we would need to do to respond to that is do one of two things. Either we say, here's the reason for every instance of evil, right? And so we give what's called a theodicy, and there's lots of theodicies, a God-justifying reason for why he permits evil. That would be one route that you could use to reject that claim that the atheists advance that there is pointless evil. The second option is to say, look, I don't know what the reason is why God allows it, but I know that God has a reason. That's actually called skeptical theism. And that's this view that, you know, we're just because we can't discern the reason as finite knowers, it doesn't mean that there isn't a reason, right? And so the skeptical theist isn't skeptical that God exists. The skeptical theist is skeptical that we can discern God's morally justified reasons for allowing evil. But the skeptical theist will say, we do know, given God's goodness, given God's existence, that he has a reason. Now, for years, I was kind of on the skeptical theist camp. Lately, and again, just trying to be really brief, I've been somewhat convinced by Eleanor Stump, who's a philosopher, in her wonderful book, Wandering in Darkness, that there might be a theodicy. In other words, there might be, if we, you know, think about some things biblically, there might be a way to explain why God allows evil. And for Stump, it all has to do with extending our God-justifying reason into eternity, right? So if all that exists is this world and there's no afterlife, well, we're just not going to be satisfied. We're not going to find a morally justified reason for all evils. You know, some things just don't heal on this side of heaven. But if we extend into the afterlife and ask, what is the highest good for humans? What is that greatest good? Well, the answer on the Christian story is a relational good. The highest good, I've already said it, is union with God. That's the thing that is our highest good and perfect happiness, is permanent, eternal union with God. And so for Stump, given that that's what our highest good is, she gives a theodicy extended into the afterlife, of course, because, you know, our highest good is permanently established when we are permanently brought into, you know, union with God forever. Then we're able to sort of give a kind of theodicy in this way. All the things that happen that are bad, all the instances of suffering and evil, are there to do one of two things. So this is just Stump's proposal, which is Aquinas's proposal. They're either meant to draw us closer to God, or they're meant to keep us from further, harm and drifting away from God. Now, what I said was pretty brief and not probably super satisfying to your listeners, but I would just say, maybe check out her book. It's sort of long, but I found it deeply nourishing. Actually, as I went through my own period of incredible loss, I read this, you know, 600-page philosophical tome and found it nourishing to the soul and the mind at the same time. And one of the big reasons why is because she unpacks this theodicy where God cares, not just, God cares for the deep desires of our hearts. And she talks about this Psalm 37, 4 or 5, where it says, you know, delight yourself in the Lord and he will give you the desires of your heart. Like, even God cares about our deep desires. And I found great comfort in that at a time of personal loss. And so anyway, all that to say, I think there are hopeful theodicies, but even if there isn't, I think that we also have good reasons. Unless God reveals it to us, we have good reasons to think we won't know in all cases God's morally justified reason. But I do think we can know that God has a reason. So anyway, that's, I don't know, probably too much, but probably not enough. But that's at least where we could start.
Well, it certainly does bring up the passage in the end of Romans chapter 11. Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments and unfathomable his ways. And for from him and through him and to him are all things, and to him be the glory forever. And as you see in the ministry of Christ here on earth, as fully divine and fully human, there was a great deal of suffering and contempt leveled at Jesus. And, you know, but he says in John, be of good cheer, I have overcome the world. And, you know, I too have gone through loss. We all have. We've all suffered different things. And as you say, you know, there's some things that just do not get healed, or problems that just do not seem to get solved this side of eternity. And those are some of the most deeply difficult and perplexing questions that we as human beings face. And it's equally difficult to argue with people who are not genuinely inquiring about this, but sort of want to know, want to hear the Christian say, "I don't know," or they mock it or they ridicule it. I think that's really hard to process for most of us who hear arguments from our friends and family of how silly we are for believing in God when there's so much wanton evil apparently out there in the world. My guest today has been Dr. Paul Gould. He is a professor of philosophy, my co-editor with The Story of the Cosmos, a good friend, and a wonderful mind on this whole topic of philosophy. He's written an excellent book with Dr. Jamie Dew. He's president of New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary. And it's a great book about philosophy for Christians, and it's very accessible and just an excellent compendium of philosophical thought with a dictionary, a glossary of terms. You have an index. It's easy, down to earth. You can take the chapters in digestible parts, and it brings up the basic components of what you're going to see when you do philosophy. And I think it's a much needed discipline that we need to incorporate into our theological devotional life, being good philosophers, loving wisdom, getting to know wisdom as wisdom is revealed through the person and the work of Jesus. Paul, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. And just want to offer some concluding thoughts to exhort our listeners to get involved with being more deliberate about knowing good philosophy. What can we do?
Yeah, thanks, Dan, for having me. It's always a joy to talk to you. And I know we're not living as close to each other now that I'm in Florida, but I've really enjoyed our time. So thank you. Yeah, in terms of, I guess, final exhortations, I mean, I would just say start where you are. You know, pick up a book, begin to familiarize yourself with some basic philosophy, and just go from there. And in fact, all of you, you know, I firmly believe that we are rational animals. And as Aristotle famously said in the Metaphysics, he says, all men desire to know. You've been created to discover and to seek truth. And I would just allow you and challenge you to awaken that longing, that passion for truth, and follow it to its source, which is Christ. You know, I believe that God has created us to be nourished on the good, the true, and the beautiful, and that we find, if we put our theology caps on and ask what is the source of goodness, truth, and beauty, the answer is Christ. And so I'd say, yeah, pick up a book. Maybe if you want advanced steps, I would invite you to come join me here at Palm Beach Atlantic University. Actually, in the fall, we are officially beginning a new master's in philosophy of religion. And we're going to go deep in every area of philosophy. And it's going to be super exciting. And we care deeply about philosophy. We care deeply about the gospel. We care deeply about culture. We care deeply about mission. And we care deeply about Christ-centered community. So consider checking out our program. You can move to sunny Florida, but you can also do it online. Or we have a hybrid option where you do some online and you do some in person. But yeah, those would be some easy and maybe more in-depth steps. But either way, just begin where you're at. Give yourself grace, but take that next step. So thanks again, Dan, for having me on. It's good to talk to you.
Absolutely, Paul, and we will keep the conversation rolling. I will continue to encourage people to read your book, along with Jamie and so many of your other works that you've authored, of course, your cultural apologetics book, Story of the Cosmos, of course, and you are just a book factory, Mr. Gould, and I appreciate you spending your valuable time with us this afternoon, and thank you for all your wonderful insights, and we will have links to Paul's work and literature and where he's at the program in Palm Beach. And so you can join in the conversation or just begin or get some good resources for solid Christian philosophy.
As Christians and stewards of creation, are we ready to give a defense of God's glory? Apologetics Profile podcasts can certainly help. Our conversational style interviews are designed to encourage and equip you to better understand the worldviews of other religions, cults, and ideas, enabling you to have more confidence in conversations with non-believers, planting seeds and pointing the way to the glory of God. If you've enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe to the Apologetics Profile podcast at Google Play, Spotify, Podomatic. You can also support the podcast by becoming a patron at patreon.com/Watchman Fellowship today. For Apologetics Profile, I'm Dave Mitchell. Thanks for listening.